From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we conclude our series on the body and the mind with a look into the minds of society's predators, murderers. What makes a person feel empowered by draining the life out of another? John Douglas, the former head of the FBI Serial Crime Unit and author of the bestseller Mindhunter, will describe his work profiling serial killers. Psychiatrist James Gilligan, former director of mental health for the Massachusetts prison system, will share what he's learned about the violent mind from his many interviews with prisoners. And forensic psychiatrist Park Dietz will consider what it means to be criminally insane. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Hurricane Edward is getting stronger again. The storm's sustained winds are back up to 130 miles an hour. And hurricane watchers are monitoring another storm, this one named Fran. Derek Reveron reports from Miami.
Forecasters predict that Edward will begin turning away from the U.S. mainland by tomorrow, and sometime this weekend, forecasters say, Edward will be located between Bermuda and North Carolina as it heads north, skirting the U.S. coastline. Right on the heels of Edward is Hurricane Fran, which threatens to strike several islands in the Northeast Caribbean. A hurricane watch has been posted for several islands, including Montserrat, Barbuda, St. Kitts, and Nevis. Forecasters predict that Fran will strengthen and pass somewhere near the islands by late tomorrow. There could be a third hurricane brewing in the Atlantic. Far behind Edward and Fran, tropical storm Gustav threatens to grow into a hurricane over the next few days. In Miami, I'm Derek Reveron reporting.
President Clinton is polishing the acceptance speech he'll give tonight at the Democratic National Convention. The president has no other public events today. He's resting his hoarse voice. The White House says Mr. Clinton will use themes tested during his whistle-stop tour in the speech and spell out how he would take the country into the next century. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat is calling today's general strike in the West Bank and Gaza Strip a success. The strike was called amid increasing Palestinian frustration with the policies of Israel's new prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Lori Neff reports from the West Bank.
Arafat says the half-day civil strike has sent a clear message to Israel and the rest of the world that things cannot continue as they are, that the peace process must move forward. Arafat spoke after talks with Jordan's prime minister in Ramallah. The Palestinian leader called the strike after Israel announced plans to expand a West Bank Jewish settlement and demolished a Palestinian community center in East Jerusalem, Israel says, was built without a license. Chief Palestinian negotiator Saeed Erekat, meanwhile, says Israel had requested he meet with his Israeli counterpart, General Dan Shembron. This could pave the way for a resumption of Palestinian-Israeli autonomy talks stalled since the election of Prime Minister Netanyahu. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Ramallah.
Some unexpectedly strong economic news has created new jitters on Wall Street. Sales of new homes jumped nearly 8% in July to the highest level in 5 months, despite a rise in mortgage interest rates. The report from the Commerce Department is the latest to suggest that the economy is not slowing as much as necessary to forestall a boost in interest rates later this year. The Commerce Department also says the economy was growing faster in the second quarter than previously estimated. The growth rate was revised upward to an annual rate of 4.8%. On Wall Street, the Dow is now down nearly 36 points at 5,676. The Nasdaq Composite Index is down about 4. This is NPR News. A 15-year-old boy is being arraigned today on charges that he set a wildfire in Southern California that has charred nearly 20,000 acres so far. It's one of a number of blazes burning in the western states. In Nevada, officials are letting some wildfires burn unchecked for lack of firefighters. A federal prosecutor has completed the government's closing arguments in the trial of three men accused of plotting to blow up U.S. passenger jets. It's unclear whether the jury deliberations will begin this week or after Labor Day. Ramzi Youssef, the alleged ringleader, and two others are accused of plotting to place bombs in a dozen jetliners over a two-day period in retaliation for U.S. support for Israel. The nation's largest airports may use bomb-sniffing dogs as part of a future plan to improve security. NPR's Chitra Raghavan has more.
After TWA Flight 800 went down last month, President Clinton appointed a commission to come up with recommendations for toughening security at airports. The commission is due to come up with its initial report soon. One plan under consideration is to have bomb-sniffing dogs at the nation's largest airports. Dogs are much cheaper than the alternative, which is to install high-tech explosive detection systems. Purchasing and training a dog costs a little more than $8,000, but the best explosive detection machine costs $1 million apiece. But dogs have their own limitations. They get tired and can only be used for a limited time each day. Their handlers are very expensive, and canines can't screen large volumes of luggage. But dogs are not as politically controversial as some of the machines, many of which don't meet current federal standards. I'm Chitra Raghavan in Washington.
The U.S. Naval Academy has abandoned its policy of requiring dorm room doors to remain open at all times. The Academy superintendent says midshipmen may now lock their doors at night. The change follows reports that a top-ranking middie has been expelled, accused of entering the rooms of four female midshipmen and sexually assaulting them. Those charges were dismissed, but he was convicted of violating the Academy's prohibition of sexual activity in the dorm. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Throughout the week, we've been featuring a series of interviews on the body and the mind. We conclude the series today with an examination of the minds of violent criminals. Be aware that our program will include several stories about gruesome crimes. Serial killers and serial rapists tend to be the most bewildering, personally disturbing, and most difficult to catch of all violent criminals, according to John Douglas. He's the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. He's the author of the bestseller Mindhunter and a book about the Unabomber. Douglas was the model for the FBI agent Jack Crawford in the novel and film Silence of the Lambs. He worked on such cases as the Atlanta child murders, the Tylenol murders, the Son of Sam, and the Unabomber. Douglas pioneered the approach of identifying a serial killer by finding his signature. The signature is those clues the killer leaves at the scene of the crime, clues that reflect the killer's personality. Now, you developed your technique for profiling serial killers and tracking them down by interviewing serial killers and serial rapists in California prisons and studying them, getting to know them. Let's look at one of the people who you interviewed and some of the things you learned by talking with him that seemed to be fairly typical of other serial killers as well. Mm-hmm. I was thinking we could look at Ed Kemper.
Okay.
And now, who was he?
Ed Kemper was extremely bright, 145 IQ. He was 6'9". He weighed 300 pounds. When he was 14 years old, he killed his grandparents and called his mom up and told mom, hey, guess what? I killed Grandma and Grandpa, and I won't be going back next summer visiting them. And so they arrested, of course, Ed Kemper, but they put him in a mental institution, and then they released him at about 18 to 19 years of age. They put him back into society, and I sarcastically will say they cured him. Well, they didn't cure him. He was the victim of a severe amount of child abuse and neglect at the hands of his mother, so they put him back in the custody of his mother. And he was what I would call asexual, asocial. He would have wanted to date, and his mother, who worked at a university, said, hey, listen, you're nothing but a bum. No matter what you do or grew up to be, you'll never be able to date these girls. So in his mind, he said, well, I'm gonna show her. So he would pick up hitchhikers around the campus. He had a university sticker on his car, so the girls, these unsuspecting hitchhikers, felt safe. He would get either one or two girls in the car. It didn't make any difference because he already rigged the door handle when they got into the vehicle. They were unable to open the door once they realized that they were going not in the place where they wanted to go. He then took them out, would kill them, would decapitate them, cut their hands off to delay identification, but then would take the heads back to his house, bury the heads outside of his mother's window, and just would fantasize about at times even having sex with these girls, although he had no sex with them, but really was trying to get back at and was getting back at mom. The case ended finally after killing seven co-eds. He killed his mother, decapitated her, and put her head on a kitchen table, and basically was kind of chewing her out for the ill treatment that he received throughout his childhood. He then fled, was arrested in Colorado. I think what I learned from an individual like this, it just kind of reinforced the fact that most of the offenders who I interviewed have all come from these dysfunctional families, almost without exception. This is not to say if you come from a dysfunctional family, you're going to grow up to be a violent offender, but of the violent offenders who I've interviewed, they've all come from this particular background.
No, I think you also found out that when this guy was young, he'd torture animals.
Right, and that's what you come in, we call the homicidal triangle, which includes animal cruelty, arson, and enuresis, which is bedwetting. And the bedwetting continues up to 8, 10, 12 years of age. The animal cruelty begins right around kindergarten, 6, 7, 8 years of age. And arson usually starts at about that time. So when you're a parent or if you're a school teacher and you see these characteristics, the odds are very, very high that that this person is going to grow up to be a violent offender. In fact, I've always said that school teachers are probably some of your best profilers because they see these things, these traits, these characteristics very, very early on.
I guess it doesn't shock me that a serial killer would have tortured animals when he was young or started fires when he was young. The bedwetting, I don't really understand.
The bedwetting has to do more of an emotional problem and not a physiological problem with them. And it's from the abuse that they're receiving at the hands of the parents. And so it's an emotional element.
You've interviewed so many serial killers. Have you found that they ever have any remorse or any sense of what it is they've actually done?
No, they'll fake it, and I'll go along with it. You'll see tears streaming down their face, but the tears are for themselves, that their life is ruined. They could care less about the victims and the families, the lives that they've ruined, but they cry for themselves, and they'll cry post-arrest, or they'll cry when you interview them in jail, but there's nothing, in fact, if you would polygraph them after the crime, that's why they're very difficult to show deception, because they feel the crimes they committed are justified. So there's nothing there.
John Douglas is the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. We'll hear more from him in the second half of our show. Some violent crimes today seem so brutal, so pointless, and the perpetrators are so lacking in remorse, it's almost hard to think of them as human. How did they get that way, we wonder? That's what Dr. James Gilligan has been trying to understand. Dr. James Gilligan is a psychiatrist who has spent 25 years working with murderers and other violent criminals. He's the former medical director of the Bridgewater State Hospital for the Criminally Insane and former director of mental health for the Massachusetts prison system. He also directed the Center for the Study of Violence at Harvard Medical School. In his recent book, Violence, he describes what he's learned about the causes of violent behavior and how to prevent it. He told me that one of the characteristics many murderers have in common is that they think of themselves as dead, the living dead.
Well, I've spoken with literally thousands of murderers over the last 25 years, and I can tell you that almost all of them have described at one time or another that they felt they had died at some point in the past, often an identifiable point. And what they mean by that is that they literally lost the capacity for feelings of aliveness, for feelings of any sort. And I mean both physical sensations and emotions. I'm talking about, the way they've described this to me, it varies from one person to another, but it all comes down to basically the same thing. Many people have told me they don't have the capacity for physical sensations. They feel like they are dead, numb, as if their bodies were filled with ropes and cords rather than nerves and blood vessels, that they feel empty inside. One person told me he felt like food that was decomposing. They've told me they've used terms like zombie, vampire, robot to describe themselves. I asked one man, for example, and many, many people at different times, why they killed somebody. The answer that came back that shocked me but fascinated me, because I thought we could learn something from it, I think of one particular man now, said, I did it because I wanted to see if I would have feelings.
Does the act of murder make someone feel more alive when he's felt dead?
In most cases, no. In most cases, it is self-defeating. Men have told me they don't feel anything. They say, does that mean I'm not alive or I'm not human, that I don't even feel remorse or guilt? And I think that is one reason why the rate of self-murder or suicide is hundreds of times to even thousands of times greater among people who commit murder than it is among the general public. When they find that committing murder doesn't enable them to feel alive, then they choose to do away with themselves.
But one of the reasons why they do murder somebody is as a test to see, will this make me feel, will I feel anything if I murder this person?
I think that's true. I wouldn't at all say that that is something that all murderers are consciously aware of at the time they do it. I mean, I'm not saying they would all put it in words that way.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems murderers have is they're so oriented toward action that they don't customarily put things into words and reflect on them. I'm telling you what I have learned from sitting down afterwards and spending often years with these people, exploring their psyches and trying to learn what, you know, could conceivably have led them to do the horrible things that they've done, to commit the atrocities they've committed.
Does this help explain why it seems that so many murderers have absolutely no empathy for their victims?
Yes. I think, first of all, the absence of feelings makes it impossible to empathize with others. The fact that they themselves feel dead means they can't understand that other people, in fact, are alive and have feelings. I'm talking about men, for example, who mutilate themselves after they have mutilated others. Once they get into prison, one thing that keeps the emergency rooms in prisons busy every single day of the week is the prison inmates who mutilate themselves in ways that are just as horrible as the ways they mutilate their victims. They do this because they don't have physical feelings at the time they do it. They'll tell me they're anesthetized at the time that they, they do things that are, frankly, too terrible to even go into over the air, frankly. Horrendous things. They do it because they don't have feelings. And if they don't have feelings about themselves, how can they empathize with other people? They can't.
You say that to understand the psychology of violence, we need to turn many of our most basic assumptions about human behavior upside down. What's an example of that?
Well, for example, I think the common sense assumption that has guided our criminal justice policies in this country has been the assumption that violent people act according to rational self-interest, as though they were all graduates of the Harvard Business School and had studied cost-benefit analyses, and that if only we increase the costs of violent behavior, the benefits won't seem quite so desirable. The fact is, these people don't think in those terms. They are totally irrational. If they were interested in rational self-interest, they wouldn't go around getting into so much trouble to begin with. These are people who feel lost, who are so desperate they don't care whether they themselves live or die.
My guest is psychiatrist James Gilligan, author of the book Violence. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Dr. James Gilligan is my guest, and he directed the Center for the Study of Violence at Harvard Medical School, and he's the former director of mental health for the Massachusetts prison system. So these are people who you say have like dead souls. They feel nothing spiritually, even physically. What are some of the conditions that they've been exposed to that have left them feeling dead?
Well, I will tell you, my experience in working with prison inmates over the last 25, almost 30 years has been to give me a whole new concept of what the term child abuse means. It's off the scale to anything I would previously have considered conceivable. The men that I've seen in the prisons who've committed the most terrible violence themselves are often the survivors of attempted murder or of the murders of their closest family members, their brothers or sisters, mothers or fathers. These are men who have been beaten, starved, raped, drugged, suffocated, tortured, thrown out of windows, set on fire, axed, treated in ways that I certainly could not have believed and would not have expected before I started working with them. So I reached the conclusion that the men who are on the you know, outer extremes of the spectrum of criminal violence as adults were also on the extreme end of the spectrum of violent child abuse as children.
Now, tell me if you think that helps explain a phenomenon that I read so much about. So often I read that somebody killed somebody because the murderer didn't like the way this person looked at them, you know, or the person did some minor trivial thing that the murderer interpreted as a sign of disrespect.
Yes, I can't tell you how often I have had prison inmates tell me when I asked them why they had assaulted somebody that it was because, quote, he disrespected me or he disrespected my visitor.
Is there a story that you could tell us about one of the prisoners who you worked with whose story kind of illustrates the point that you're making about disrespect?
Well, one particular inmate had a powerful impact on me and actually helped me to clarify my understanding of the subject almost more than anybody else. This was a man who had murdered a young woman who had been a high school classmate of his, and he himself was only about 19 at the time. She was about 18. He not only murdered her, but he also cut out her eyes and her tongue. The sheer horror of this just stopped me cold. And I also thought, you know, I had thought I had begun to understand the causes of violence, but this one absolutely stumped me. I was totally stopped. I said, how in the world could I possibly understand such a brutal atrocity? And it was only later in the course of talking with him that I realized the answer, no pun intended, was staring me in the eye. That this man was somebody who felt overwhelmed by feelings of shame and humiliation. He had gone through his childhood, as I learned and as he described to me and to others, being taunted by other people as, quote, a wimp, a punk, and a pussy. We all know what a wimp is. A punk is the prison slang term for the passive homosexual sex object of a more powerful man. And pussy is the slang term, derogatory kind of sexist term for a woman. So this is a man who was saying he felt he was treated as though he was not a man. He was shamed and humiliated. His sense of masculinity was wiped out. His crime, I felt, could only be understandable when we took that psychology into account. Why would he have focused on the eyes and tongue of his victim? I think I've already anticipated the answer. Shame dwells in the eyes. People feel shamed in the eyes of other people if they're visible. It also dwells in the tongue, in the sense that if people are gossiped about, it's through gossiping that people shame each other. There's a folk song that Carl Sandburg, the poet, used to sing, in which a condemned murderer is standing under the gallows about to be lynched for committing a murder. And his song is, my name it is Sam Hall, it is Sam Hall, and I hate you one and all, one and all. God damn your eyes. And that song, which Eric Erickson quotes in his discussions of shame, to me, finally made sense of this murderer. The psychology going on was a kind of very primitive physical logic, which was, if I wipe out eyes and tongues, then I cannot be shamed. I can wipe out shame, because I can only be shamed in the eyes and tongues of other people.
So it seems that one thing that the profiles of many murderers have in common is the sense that that they've been shamed, and that they're, yes, really lacking in self-esteem. So does murder increase a killer's self-esteem?
Fortunately or unfortunately, it is primarily a self-defeating policy. I'd say it, if it works at all, it's only in the sense that drinking salt water, you know, as a method of trying to alleviate thirst, works but doesn't work. The people that I've seen don't feel better afterwards. And in fact, one reason that serial murderers commit serial murder is again, it's like the psychology of drinking salt water to alleviate thirst. It doesn't work. It's self-defeating. And that's why, as I said earlier, so many murderers follow up the act of murder with a suicide. They discover that nothing is going to enable them to feel good about themselves. Nothing is going to heal the, what analysts call the narcissistic wounds that they suffered earlier in their lives.
But they may think that murder will help. They maybe believe before the act of murder that murder might help them feel, that murder might boost their self-esteem.
Yes. That is an illusion that murderers suffer from, which is why they commit murder, and then they discover it doesn't work. It's also an illusion that people who believe in capital punishment suffer from, when they assume that capital punishment will help them to feel better. And as Sister Helen Prejean pointed out in her book on capital punishment recently, Dead Man Walking, that doesn't work either. She describes people, the families of people who've been murdered, who continue to feel, even after the murderer was executed, that they wanted him to be executed again, or executed more slowly, or executed more painfully. None of us, it doesn't work. There's no end to revenge.
Dr. James Gilligan is a psychiatrist who teaches at Harvard Medical School. He's former director of mental health for the Massachusetts prison system and author of the book Violence. Our interview was recorded last April. We'll continue our examination of the minds of murderers on the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more from John Douglas, the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. His pioneering approach to identifying serial killers is based on what he learned interviewing over 150 convicted murderers. He'll tell us about his approach to interviewing killers. And forensic psychiatrist Park Dietz will examine what it means to be criminally insane. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross with more of our examination into the minds of murderers. John Douglas, who we heard from earlier in our show, is an expert in identifying serial killers. He's the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit and author of the bestseller Mindhunter and a book about the search for the Unabomber. He developed his theories about the minds of serial killers by interviewing over 150 convicted killers, including Charles Manson, Richard Speck, and Gary Heidnik. What's it like for you, what was it like for you to go into prison and do a personality profile of somebody who, you know, murdered or decapitated a bunch of people? I mean, it's not like the kind of interviewing I do.
No, and it takes its toll on you. And many of the people that work for me had difficulty doing this. And the thing you have to do when you do the interview is you have to do the research. You have to go in there armed with materials regarding the crime. You must look at the crime scene photographs. You must look, if it's a rapist, look at that rapist's style, that verbal, the sexual, the physical assault that he inflicted on this victim. So you must listen, you do the interview, you listen to them, and then after 4 or 5 hours, then you got to go after them and then say, look, I know you're BSing me here. You're trying to pull the wool over my eyes. I don't really care about... you know, that you kill these victims. I do really care, but I can't let him know this. And I'll say, what I really am interested in is how you're able to elude the police for so long. And then I may start telling the killer, if it's a killer I'm talking to, things about himself. For example, I'll say, I know there was a precipitating event leading up to these crimes that pushed you over the top. And I knew there were certain things, you know, going on in your life that you know, that people aren't aware of. But let me tell you about yourself, and then I'll go in and I'll start analyzing their crime. And I may say, in this one case that I talk about, a guy named Charlie Davis. I said, Charlie, I know you didn't like this particular kill. I said, how do you know that? I says, because after you killed her, you turned her over, you pushed her away from you, and you covered her body up. And I said, what is it, Charlie? What didn't you like about that? And he looks at me, and he got all red, all flushed. And he said, well, when I was, after I raped her, and I knew I had to kill her, she started to beg for life, and she told me that her husband was sick, and she had psychological problems, emotional problems of various types. I felt something towards this victim that I did not want to kill her. So that's why I turned her over, and in fact, I strangled her from the back. I didn't want to look in her eyes. But then I said, now you took something from her, Charlie, didn't you? And I don't ask the question, did you take something, Charlie? I said, I'm very positive because I know the personality. I said, you took something, didn't you? And then what happens is he went into this trance-like state, and he said, I looked in her purse, and in her purse I found a photograph. And the photograph was a picture of her husband and her and her dog sitting before a Christmas tree. And then I said, you did something with that photograph, didn't you, Charlie? What was it? And he kind of looked, I have him back at the scene now. I said, you went to the gravesite, didn't you, Charlie? And he looks at me and he says, yes. What did you do? And he said, I know he's not lying to me because I could just see the verbals, and I could just see his nonverbal communication, and he's flushed. He said, I put that photograph at that grave. I buried it just a few inches below the soil. So you really learn. But to do what I do, you have to walk in the shoes of the killer, walk in the shoes of the victim. But it takes an emotional toll.
One of the things you did at the FBI was to create a style of interviewing serial killers or accused mm-hmm. serial killers. And tell the Bloody Rock story.
Oh, this was in Adairsville, Georgia, and where a young girl, Marie Stoner, was abducted after being dropped off on a school bus in front of her home. They found her body about 10, 11 miles away in a Lover's Lane area. Mary Stoner was only 14 years of age at the time. She would be killed by the use of a rock, about a 45-pound rock that was picked up by the offender and carried over to her while she was on the ground still, because he attempted to strangle her with his hands. He didn't have the strength enough to do it. So she was unconscious. So he drops this rock on her head several times and killing Mary Stoner. So I did a profile of the offender, that this would be someone I felt that he would be in his mid to late 20s. There's a degree of sophistication. He's fairly organized. He was able to lure her into his car because it would take a car to drive her to this particular location. He'll be in a menial occupation and probably even maybe working in that area during that during the last week or several weeks. You're going to find that he's had problems most very, very recently with a woman. Could be married, separated, whatever. But then rather than strike out at her, he's going to go on the hunt and look for a potential victim of opportunity. But I said, this particular girl, it was very outgoing, low-risk victim, but every day she'd come home wearing this short skirt. So here you had an offender that was in the area looking at her, but his totally misinterpreting what he sees. He actually thinks that this girl is going to go willingly with him, have sex, and then go home to his house. And I said, he did not feel good about this homicide. I said, well, what do you mean by that? And I said, well, because check your records. I bet he strangled this girl from the back with her back turned to him. And they came back later and they said, yes, you're right. How do you know that? I said, because when he was raping this girl in the car, he did not expect what would happen next. And that's when you have to walk in the shoes of the victim. And what when you walk in her shoes, and what I attempted to do and try to feel was that she was under an extreme amount of pain. She was crying. She was sobbing. Please take me home. I'll do anything. But he knew now he lost control of the situation, so he had to kill her. And so then he picks up this rock and drops this rock on her head several times. So John, they said, you interviewed a guy. We've interviewed a guy now, but you're describing him to a T. We've just released him. We have him scheduled for the polygraph today. I said, hey, go ahead, but you're going to get no deception or inconclusive. They call me back up and they say, John, you're right. We got inconclusive at best, and it appears to be no deception. But he fits this profile. I said, okay, let's do a nighttime interview, and we're going to bring the rock, introduce the rock into the interview environment. I want a nighttime interview because I want him, on one hand, to feel comfortable in this environment, but I want to create stress, and the stress will be the murder weapon. If, in fact, he is the killer, he will respond to that murder weapon. But place the murder weapon on a 45-degree angle off in the corner of the room and bring him in, just for a routine type of questioning again.
So when you put the rock in the room, the bloody mm-hmm. rock that was the murder weapon, how did the serial killer respond to it? What clues did he give you that he was actually the killer?
Okay, what happened was, different from the prior interviews, they said he was very cocky, very assured of himself. He goes into the room, he sits down, he looks over, and he sees this rock. Right away, they can see his respiration increases. He's beginning to, his heart, they're looking at his artery, carotid artery in his throat. They could see it beating. They could see he's perspiring. He's crossing his arms, crossing his legs. And he's really getting tense from looking at this particular, it's the murder weapon.
And he can't take his eyes off of it?
Can't take his eyes off of it. And so the other thing you have to do to get him to confess, because he killed a 14-year-old girl and he's 27, 28 at the time, is you have to provide a face-saving scenario. It's a horrible thing to do when you hear what you have to say, but what you have to say to get the confession is that the girl, in essence, she was the seducer, that she kind of put him up to this, but you, Mr. Killer, you've lost control. You lost control of the situation, and through fear, you killed her, almost like an accident type of thing. And so they did that. They took that advice, and lo and behold, he confesses to that particular rape murder, but also to a rape 3 years earlier in it was Rome, Georgia. So that was one of the first experiments that I did, and over the years, I've learned to try to find something at the crime scene, something that only the killer or whatever the crime may be would react to that particular stressor.
John Douglas, recorded last December. He's the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit and author of the bestseller Mindhunter. Coming up, forensic psychiatrist Park Dietz. This is Fresh Air. Park Dietz is a forensic psychiatrist, often called on to serve as an expert witness in criminal cases. A clinical psychiatrist tries to help the patient. A forensic psychiatrist is more like a detective who examines all of the evidence to try to find the truth. Park Dietz has testified in the trials of O.J. Simpson, the Menendez brothers, Polly Klass, Jeffrey Dahmer, John Hinckley, and Joel Rifkin. He's also the forensic psychiatrist for the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime. A lot of your work has dealt with evaluating whether a killer was criminally insane. I think it's always hard for lay people like me to understand the law's definition of sane and insane. For instance, with someone like Jeffrey Dahmer, and you were an expert witness on his case, it's hard to fathom how a serial killer who ate parts of his victims could possibly be sane in the way that I think of sanity.
Sure. Sane and insane are quite unfortunate old legal terms. If one changes those terms to responsible and not responsible, it all makes a lot more sense. There are a lot of individuals who are quite sick, mentally ill, but who are nonetheless responsible because the nature of their mental illness was such that it didn't affect those particular mental functions that the law looks at in measuring responsibility. So, for example, even many of the people who are raving lunatics by any ordinary understanding of that concept will nonetheless know that it's wrong to steal a car, for example. And if they steal a car, they do it knowing that it's against the law, that they could get caught, and that this is a wrong thing, and they could also have gotten where they want to go without stealing the car. Now, that's all the law requires, really, to hold them responsible for stealing the car. They have to know it's wrong, and they have to have the ability to choose some other way to behave.
Now, you argued that Jeffrey Dahmer was sane when he committed his crimes. What evidence did you come across that helped you reach that determination?
Actually, I didn't argue that. Early in my career, I made the mistake of arguing, and now I just present evidence to the jury and let the lawyers do the arguing.
Mm-hmm.
But the evidence that Dahmer was responsible was pretty overwhelming. All the experts who examined him agreed that he was responsible with respect to whether he knew right from wrong and whether he knew these acts were wrong. There was no disagreement there. The sole disagreement was whether he could control himself. And the defense argument was that he could not control himself because his perversions made him want to do this so badly that it was a compulsion. The government's argument was that even though he had perversions that made him want to do these things, he had the same ability to control his behavior as anyone else does. And the kind of analogy that I made before the jury was that the fact that Mr. Dahmer used a condom before each of his sexual interludes with his victims indicated that his ability to restrain his impulses was somewhat greater than the average teenager in the back seat with his girlfriend.
No, was the fact that he used a condom evidence that had already been discovered, or is that something you had to find out about?
I think I'm the only one who asked. And that's an example of how asking the right questions matters.
Why did you ask? Why did you think of asking?
Because when I'm doing my job well, I am able to put myself in the place of the offender and to imagine what that's like for that offender. What are they thinking about? What are their choices? What are they seeing?
Now, let's get back to Jeffrey Dahmer. You said you realized you should ask whether he used condoms. Who did you ask?
I asked him. I spent 3 days examining him on videotape as part of my preparation. and he was very forthcoming. He and I even sat together and watched the videos that had been seized from his home, both pornographic videos and the things that he thought were important, which most people don't think of as pornography, like The Exorcist 3 or Return of the Jedi. But for him, they had sexy scenes in which people used power to control others.
So he got turned on by scenes? What scenes?
In Return of the Jedi, it was a scene in which the head bad guy causes the Luke Skywalker to writhe on the ground in pain using some kind of magical ray. And Dahmer thought that was a great scene. He used to have his victims watch that with him before he drugged them.
Now, was he surprised that you didn't think this scene was a real turn-on? Did he think that other people shared his sexual tastes?
No, not of course not. He knew that he was quite out of place with his tastes. The man was not at all out of touch with reality, but he had very peculiar tastes and, unfortunately, very limited ability to meet his needs in legitimate ways. Another man with the same perversions could well have found a partner who had the same interests, which were to lie next to each other and fondle and be gentle and not do the painful things that some male lovers do with each other. He was actually a far more gentle man than people can appreciate. His death saddens me.
Were you surprised that he died? That he was killed in prison?
I was surprised that he was back in population so quickly. Last I'd heard, he was in protective custody, which was appropriate, and apparently for close to a year, he's been in population. So it was inevitable. He got two kinds of bad press that made this inevitable. One was about what he actually did, and of course, that's tragic and horrible, and everyone would agree. But there were two false impressions given of him. One was that he was a bloodthirsty cannibal, and the other was that he was a racist, doing this to people of color. And neither of those is true. With respect to his being a racist, in fact, he was an equal opportunity killer. He selected these victims because he found them attractive. This was his seduction, his courtship. Now, what he did to them, obviously, is horrible. But most of the acts that have entered popular lore were things he did by way of disposing of evidence. He mutilated the bodies merely for the expedient purpose of getting them out of his apartment in a manner that no one would be able to trace to him. And he had a fairly elaborate system, almost a factory for disposing of human remains, with vats of acid and storage bins. The reason there were so many parts of bodies left at the time he was caught is that he'd fallen behind. He had killed more people than he had the means to dispose of, and so it was a production line deficit. If he'd had his way, that evidence would not have been there.
My guest is Park Dietz. He's the forensic psychiatrist for the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Back with forensic psychiatrist Park Dietz. Getting back to everybody's question, how can somebody who is eating some of the remains of his victims be sane? Are there questions you asked Jeffrey Dahmer about cannibalism to test his responsibility?
Well, Of course, he was not charged with cannibalism. He was charged with the homicide. Mm-hmm. So the only moments that mattered with respect to his responsibility were the moments during which he killed his victims. At those moments, he was always intoxicated because he found the killing repulsive, and he had to get himself drunk to kill the unconscious victims whom he feared would wake up and get him in trouble. So he was killing them in order to be able to keep them around a little while longer and evade arrest for what he'd already done by drugging them and using them while they were unconscious. The cannibalism obviously was of considerable interest. We don't get to examine many people who've done that, but the extent of what he had done was far less than one might imagine. He had, in fact, filleted some muscle tissue, which he'd kept in the refrigerator, and he had consumed small portions of muscles from a few of the victims that he found most attractive. The meaning of that to him by that stage was largely related to his finding those men the most attractive to him, wishing that they didn't have to die in order for him to fulfill himself, longing to have them still around as living partners, and feeling somehow this would make them a part of him and make their death less of a waste. Now, that's a kind of primitive idea. It's very related to rituals in many societies, including our own ritual of Holy Communion, in which the theory is that one takes into oneself the flesh of another by consuming it in this way, and therefore that person becomes part of oneself.
So what was the most educational aspect for you about hearing him describe his reasons for cannibalizing some of his victims? Since, as you said, it's rare to hear, to be able to talk to somebody who's done that.
Well, you see, I went into all the details with him. I asked him how he prepared it and whether he did anything to make it a romantic occasion, since he'd implied that this was somehow connected to his sexual interests. I asked him if he had candlelight or wine or anything special, and the answer to that was no. But he did look at photographs of the victims while they were alive, while he would consume part of them, and he came to find that somewhat sexy. He was experimenting on the fringe. Now, I predicted 15 years ago that when the culture ran out of ways to play with sadomasochistic sexuality, the last frontier would be erotic cannibalism. And there have been a number of elements of the popular culture that have promoted that idea, from the covers of certain rock and roll albums to some experimental theater that's played with the idea to the great attention given to Dahmer's crimes. But there really isn't much else. I mean, there are now specialized magazines for necrophiles, and there's an enormous amount of material for people involved in sadomasochism and bondage. And erotic cannibalism is the last frontier of the perverse.
Is there a difference between a perversion and a pathology?
Well, perversion is a kind of pathology. Some people who are critical of psychiatry would say that psychiatry shouldn't even deal with the issue of perversion, that it's all moral. I think they're wrong. I think that perversion is a mental disorder. And when I say perversion, I'm referring to what we technically call paraphilias, meaning an unusual activity that causes arousal. And this does not refer to whether people are straight or gay. It refers to an interest in children or in pain or in other things that are socially unacceptable. And the evidence seems stronger and stronger all the time that perversions are learned. There may be some individual differences in who's vulnerable to learning it that accounts for why some people become perverted and others don't. But it's unquestionable now that what it is that turns someone on is learned.
So in other words, you think that somebody can learn to have an association between sex and violence?
Absolutely. In the same way that men become leg men or breast men or these other kinds of stereotypes, there are people who become pain men. Women acquire these desires considerably less often by all accounts. And there's some thinking behind why that may be, but what's clear is that men are far more likely to become perverted and to commit crimes in the service of their perversions. But to be a sex criminal out of perversion, one has to be more than perverted. The chilling thing is to recognize that there are very large numbers of people, no one knows how large, who have these perversions and never act on them in any criminal manner. They find some lawful adaptation, a partner who is agreeable to engaging in the acts, fantasy. If they're willing to go a little outside the law, they'll find paid partners or use pornography or go to specialized clubs that will deliver these services. But if there's going to be a crime, if they're going to hurt people to fulfill themselves, there always has to be a second problem beside the perversion. Most often, that's an antisocial character, is the second problem. Sometimes it's alcoholism, as in the case of Dahmer. That's his second problem. Sometimes it's other kinds of character problems, and quite rarely it's a coincidental mental illness. Once every year or so, we'll have a case come through the office where someone who was perverse and never acted on it for many years acts on it when they get psychotically depressed, or when they have their first schizophrenic break.
Park Dietz is a forensic psychiatrist for the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime. He heads the Threat Assessment Group in Newport Beach, California. Our interview was recorded in December of 1994. Today's program on the mind of the murderer concludes our series on the body and the mind. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program today was produced by Roberta Schirach. Today we say goodbye to our researcher, Rena Bander. She spent the past year in libraries around Philadelphia digging up pertinent books and articles about our guests to help me prepare and to ensure that I have no free time to get into trouble. We'll miss her good work, and we'll miss her. We wish her good luck in her move to Boston. I'm Cheri Gross.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, actor Dennis Hopper talks about another side of his life, collecting art. He plays an art collector in the new film Basquiat. Also, Roots rock performer Dave Alvin reads his poetry. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.